It is Wednesday, October 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, China's leader presents his vision for a new era for the country. Newly released documents indicate U.S. officials were aware of mass killings by the Indonesian army against suspected communists in the mid-1960s. And we look at eating for better mental health. It's all ahead. Chinese President Xi Jinping gave a sober assessment of the challenges facing the world's second largest economy and its ruling Communist Party at the opening session of the 19th Party Congress. He laid out an ambitious vision that stretches forward to the middle of the century and pledged to build what he called a modern socialist country for a new era. In a near 3.5-hour speech at the opening session of the Congress, she spoke confidently about the country's future and its opportunities. He also stressed that an increasingly strong Communist Party would continue to chart the path forward. I spoke with Sarah Cook, senior research analyst at Freedom House, a U.S.-based non-government organization. She told me she stressed continuity.
A certain number of changes, though I wouldn't call them reforms, whether it's in the economic sphere or a new leadership group on related to legal matters, it's all within the existing structure. I think his remarks and talk about a new era may have a bit more to really do with China's place in the world as opposed to any kind of real change in how the Communist Party governs China itself.
How does he see China's place in the world?
How does he phrase it? Oh, of course, the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. I think there's this sense of China returning to, you know, its previous position as a world power and, you know, being able to influence the international system, you know, as a major power in the world. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that he sees, and it's certainly the case given the fact of China's economy. I think what's tricky is that it is an authoritarian-led regime, and those kinds of regimes tend to be more aggressive militarily abroad. We already see, even non-military terms, how China's impact on democracy and freedom in other countries can have a negative effect because of Communist Party efforts to influence what's happening there, particularly on certain topics and policy areas. So I think it's really quite tricky how it plays out, but from Xi's perspective, you know, this is, you know, now China's arrived at a place that it really is able to take a leading role in the world, and that will only increase over the next 3 or 4 decades.
Does this party Congress demonstrate Xi's, how he solidified his position in power?
I think, you know, we don't quite know that yet. There've certainly been things online of people saying that the fact that he got, you know, China's political elite to sit through a 3.5-hour speech was perhaps a demonstration, you know, of his hold on power. I think, you know, the real verdict on that is probably going to come out a little more clearly later in the Congress when the new lineup of the Politburo Standing Committee is announced. And I think then we'll see kind of how his allies fared in the various backdoor dealings and factional infighting that has been happening for a few months and is probably going to continue over the coming week.
Well, meanwhile, as leader, he has led this great crackdown against any kind of opposition. You know, he has imprisoned most, it seems like, human rights lawyers. Do you think China will continue to restrict the freedom of its people?
Unfortunately, yes. I think things are going to get worse before they get better. And even though Xi used the word democracy and democratic in a few places, the Communist Party's definition of democracy is very different than that of the rest of the world. And I think the emphasis on party leadership and party control, and I think he made some remarks related to internet controls, I think that points to a continuation of what we've seen. But I think a lot of that has unintended consequences in the sense that we've seen in our research, as repression expands, so does resentment and resistance and pushback. So in the case of the Chinese human rights lawyers, even, as more have been detained, you know, there's actually been, you know, there's periodically a new generation of other lawyers who come up to defend their colleagues or to take up some of the cases that they haven't been able to take. So we're still seeing human rights lawyers trying to defend people like Falun Gong practitioners, but I think that desire and that certainly a sense of people in China wanting some of these basic freedoms and justice hasn't changed.
Sarah Cook, Senior Research Analyst at Freedom House. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, there's a story trending today that goes all the way back a couple of weeks to the beginning of October when four U.S. soldiers were killed in an attack in Niger. Still questions as to what happened with that, a terrorist attack, a shootout that went on, but leaving those four soldiers dead. Today, one of those soldiers, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, was returned back to the U.S., and photos making the rounds on social media show Johnson's wife hunched over his flag-draped casket as it comes off the plane, standing there. That's evoking quite an emotional response on social media. But the other trending story that we're seeing, in addition to that photo going around, is a comment from Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. She was with the Johnson family, and she was with them. Johnson's widow got a phone call from President Trump, and this congresswoman said she overheard the call and overheard President Trump tell Johnson's widow that he must have known what he signed up for, but it's very sad anyway. So she has said this was very distasteful. It's getting a lot of attention on social media. People aghast that the president would say that he knew that he could die or knew that he was going to die, but he did it anyway. President Trump is responding to that on Twitter. He said, "Democrat Congresswoman totally fabricated what I said to the wife of a soldier who died in action. And I have proof," he says, "sad." So unclear who got the story right, who got this wrong. As oftentimes is the case, it's somewhere in between. So I think that that's probably going to be the case here. Whether the president has proof or not remains to be seen and how that manifests itself. But as that controversy swirls, people are using social media to do some good in this case. They're raising money to support Johnson's widow and their children. They had two children and one unborn child. One effort I saw on social media sought to raise $5,000. Instead, it raised over $25,000 and counting for those children. So there is some good coming out of this terrible story. And speaking of instances where it's, you know, this kind of somewhere in between, there's no right or wrong, we're definitely seeing that today on Capitol Hill, where Attorney General Jeff Sessions is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee about the investigation into Russia and the firing of FBI Director James Comey. The one thing I'm struck by as I've seen the comments on social media, Sarah, is it's amazing how two different groups of people can get such radically different impressions from this hearing watching the same exact thing on television. because you have people saying it's a waste of time and money because Sessions won't tell the truth and he's lying. You have others that are saying it's a waste of time and money because it's a political witch hunt. You have people talking about Senator Al Franken, who had a pointed line of questioning, saying that he really stuck it to Jeff Sessions. Other people saying that he was rude or imbalanced. It's amazing to see this back and forth. It's something we've seen throughout, really the beginning of social media, the division politically. But something new that we are seeing more and more are that these hearings become kind of political theater on social media in particular, and it becomes something that everyone is attuned to and watching, and it becomes a trending topic as different senators ask questions, as different moments pop up. And so that's what we're seeing today on Capitol Hill.
Everything's so polarized.
Everything is so polarized. Social media, unfortunately, is no different.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. Attorney General says respect for the rule of law has eroded. President Trump is unclear about support for bipartisan accord on health care changes. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says that the U.S. holds Myanmar's military leadership responsible for the Rohingya crisis. And UN judges will decide next week on a verdict in the trial of former Bosnian Serb army leader Ratko Mladic. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The recent gravitational wave detection and observations of the cosmic event that triggered it have provided scientists with a number of new insights. Among the new findings include confirmation of the origin of elements such as gold and platinum in the universe. The newly detected gravitational waves are thought by scientists to have been produced by the violent collision and merger of two neutron stars, the smallest yet densest stars known to exist. After observing light produced by the merger event called a kilonova, scientists say that large amounts of heavy elements, such as gold, platinum, and uranium, were created and pumped out into the universe. Scientists estimate that this kilonova, powered by extreme nuclear reactions, produced as much gold as the mass of the Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at how healthy eating can improve mental health. This week, nearly 30,000 pages of declassified records from the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta between 1964 and 1968 were published. The period includes the Indonesian military's apparent mass killing of 500,000 to 100 suspected communists in 1965 to 1966. I spoke with Brad Simpson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut. He tells me what the records show.
We have known for a number of years that U.S. officials were aware of the Indonesian military's campaign of mass murder against alleged members of the Communist Party. And we should say alleged members of the Communist Party because we have no idea of knowing just how many of those who were killed, perhaps up to 500,000 between October of 1965 and March of 1966, were actually members of the Indonesian Communist Party. Or one of its affiliated organizations. We have also known for a number of years that the United States was not just an unwitting bystander, but an active supporter of the Army's campaign to try and exterminate the Communist Party and its affiliated organizations, and provided financial assistance, communications equipment, weapons, and diplomatic support as the Army carried out its campaign. What these documents show in even greater and in some ways more disturbing detail is just how closely U.S. officials at the embassy in Jakarta were monitoring the progress of the campaign of mass killings against the PKI. These documents reveal that U.S. embassy officials had assembled lists of Communist Party leaders, tracking which had been arrested and which had been murdered. I won't say executed, because none of these people were given any sort of judicial process. They were simply murdered in most cases. And it was clear that U.S. officials were aware that this was happening because they were receiving very detailed reports of which PKI officials had been arrested, which had been murdered, and which were still at large. The second thing that these documents reveal, important revelation, is that U.S. officials were aware from the very beginning that the vast majority of those who were being killed had no knowledge of or participation in the September 30th movement, which was the ostensible reason for the Army's campaign of repression and mass murder in the first place. One of the documents cites a U.S. embassy official who had met with an Australian journalist who had traveled quite widely around the country and reported that none of the PKI leaders and rank and file that he met with had any idea of the September 30th movement, had no foreknowledge of it, had no idea that it was coming, and really had no idea how to respond.
With the context of this, this was going on during the Vietnam War. And would one of the reasons that the U.S. officials were against the Communist Party was because, I guess, their concerns about growth of communism within Asia.
Yes, the U.S. was deeply concerned with the increasing leftward tilt of the Indonesian government, which was then under the leadership of President Sukarno. U.S. officials in the Johnson administration were also deeply worried by the increasing radicalism and anti-American activism of the Indonesian Communist Party, which had tilted in the direction of China over the Soviet Union and was, as a result, pursuing an increasingly militant political campaign inside Indonesia, which was raising lots of concerns, not just among U.S. officials, but also among other Western officials. So the Vietnam War looms large over these events.
Brad Simpson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. There's an old saying, you are what you eat. Eat the right foods and you'll feel better physically. Turns out what you eat can also help you feel better emotionally and mentally. Faiza Al-Mesri has more details about cooking up a good mood in the kitchen. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Therapist Leslie Korn has been treating people for trauma and depression for more than 40 years. She noticed that when her patients changed their diet and began eating foods like dark chocolate, sweet potatoes, eggs, and cherries, they had much more success in lifting their depression and decreasing their pain.
Think about our body in some ways like a car engine. We need to give it the right fuel, and each of us has a need for a particular combination of proteins and carbohydrates and fats.
She turned her observations into a book, The Good Mood Kitchen, Simple Recipes and Nutrition Tips for Emotional Balance. In it, she explains the benefits of specific foods like fats.
The brain is made up of fat, and it's made up of chemicals that talk to each other and that are lubricated by the fat in order to communicate across the synapses and contribute to our ability to focus, to apply attention, and to lift our mood. Indeed, there's some very good research going on in the military looking at the role of omega-3 fatty acids for not only treatment of depression and anxiety, but also for suicide prevention.
Wild salmon is a rich source of omega-3 fatty acids, and Korn includes an easy recipe for it. Sprinkle sea salt and olive oil on the salmon, bake it for 10 minutes, then place it under the broiler for 5 minutes. Taking care of the digestive system, which breaks down the fat, is essential for the brain to benefit. And Korn has a suggestion for that, too.
For example, if your liver and your gallbladder isn't working, you can't break down the fats that are then absorbed into the bloodstream and then support brain function. What we know is that the greens, in particular the bitter greens, help us digest fats and send those fats to the brain where we need it.
Those greens are part of what Korn calls the rainbow diet.
I call this the rainbow diet because the colors in food represent different nutrients. And so your orange and kind of yellow foods provide lots of vitamin A and lots of phytonutrients. The variety of greens were very good for our digestion. Your purple foods and your red foods are very anti-inflammatory. Those are beets and our eggplant and our berries.
Every country, Korn says, has certain foods that enhance mental well-being. In her book, she offers recipes for them. Fresh raw sauerkraut from Eastern Europe, kimchi from Korea, and miso soup from Japan. Plantain is a popular food in India, Mexico, and countries in Africa and the Caribbean. Korn has a recipe for plantain soup.
Plantain are a large banana, very starchy and a little bit of sweet. And I add some lemon and butter and chopped onion and garlic. And you make it with either a vegetable broth or a chicken broth. And then you add coconut milk and blend. And then I top it with a cilantro, a Chinese parsley, garlic, and grated orange peel and lime juice.
But it's not just about the food, Korn says. Once you've prepared a dish designed to improve your emotional balance, it's important to slow down, take some deep breaths, and enjoy the meal. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. It sounds delicious. And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 11 years since renowned Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment building in Moscow after she exposed human rights abuses in Chechnya and corruption in the Kremlin. In June 2014, sentences were handed down to five individuals for her murder, but the mastermind who ordered her killing remains unknown, more than a decade after her death. On the most recent anniversary of her murder, U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert called on Russian authorities to identify and prosecute the person or persons who ordered, planned, and funded this terrible crime. According to the latest State Department annual report on human rights, in 2016, no progress was reported in establishing accountability for Ms. Politkovskaya's death or for the killing of other high-profile journalists, such as Paul Klebnikov in Moscow in 2004 or Natalia Estemirova in Chechnya in 2009. The State Department report noted that journalists in Russia continued to be subjected to arrest, imprisonment, physical attack, harassment, and intimidation as a result of their work. Journalists reporting in or on the North Caucasus remain particularly vulnerable to physical attacks for their reporting, the State Department said. In her statement on the anniversary of Anna Politkovskaya's death, spokesperson Nauert wrote that Ms. Politkovskaya's reporting brought to light the violation of human rights in Russia and the suffering of victims of the war in the North Caucasus region. She noted that recent reports of abuses against LGBTI persons and extrajudicial killings in Chechnya leave us deeply concerned that human rights violations are still regularly committed with impunity in this region. The unsolved murders of Ms. Politkovskaya, a dual U.S.-Russia citizen, and other journalists in Russia, as well as threats against journalists exposing more recent abuses in Chechnya, Ms. Nauert said, have only worsened an atmosphere of intimidation for the independent press. From its founding, the United States has recognized that a free and independent press is indispensable to democratic governance and the rule of law. The Russian people deserve that their government recognize free expression as a fundamental human right that must be protected, not flouted or crushed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.